Hello, my name is Leroy Chatfield, director of the Farm Worker Movement Documentation Project. Today is June 10th, 2009. This interview with Rudy Amada will be another in a series of oral history interviews on the subject, Growing Up in a Migrant Worker Family. It will be published on the website of the Farm Worker Documentation Project, www.farmworkermovement.us, and can be found in the oral history section. To begin the interview, I will ask Mr. Amada to state his name, his current occupation and title, and recall for us the circumstances about where and when he first met Cesar Chavez, the founder of the Farm Worker Movement. Mr. Amada?
Yes, my name is Rudy Almada, and I am currently the chief financial officer of Sacramento Loaves and Fishes, which is a charity whose purpose is to provide hot meals for the homeless in the safe haven. I first met Cesar Chavez in the early days of the strike, maybe 1 or 2 days into the strike, or 3 days, perhaps, at a rally at Filipino Hall in Delano, California.
What year would that have been?
Pardon?
What year?
September 1965, that's when the strike began. And it was actually my first face-to-face contact with him.
And your first impression?
My first impression of Cesar Chavez was he was a dynamic speaker, very bright, a leader. He could a lot of charisma. People were really attracted to him. They listened to what he had to say. He was very strong in what he had to say, and he had this look in his eyes that he could basically see through a person and what they were thinking.
Okay. From previous conversations with you, it seems to me that your life falls into two categories, generally speaking. First, growing up in a farm worker family and your association with the farm worker movement would be one category. And then a second category would be after you left the movement and your professional career that followed after that. What I'd like to do is begin with the second category first. Can you tell me what year you left Delano, and how old were you, and what was your next step?
When I left Delano, after I was involved with the Farm Workers Union?
Yes, after you were involved with the Farm Workers Union.
I left Delano about August of 1971. I was probably about 25 years old. I left there and I went to work in Los Angeles, East Los Angeles, California, for a community group whose name was the East Los Angeles Community Union. I became the chief financial officer for the organization, which later became what was called in those days a community development corporation, which was funded by the Office of Economic Opportunity. I was there until January of 1975, when I came to Sacramento, California, to work with Governor Jerry Brown. Leroy Chatfield had recruited me, and I became the controller at the governor's office, a position I held from 1975, early 75, till February of 1979, at which time I was appointed to the Youthful Offender Parole Board. In that capacity, we interviewed wards that were incarcerated in the California Youth Authority. I was there during that process also, I became vice chairman, and at one point I became the acting chairperson of the board. I served for a period of 6 years, and at which time there was a change in governorship, and Governor George Turkmazian came in, and at the end of my term, I left, and I went to work for a community mental health center in East Los Angeles, working with the mentally ill. My position there was Vice President of Finance and Administration. The organization was basically a community mental health center, which dealt with a variety of outpatient programs for the mentally ill in East Los Angeles. And we were funded by the County of Los Angeles and the State of California. We had a staff of about 150, and we had a budget of a little over $5 million. My tenure there ended in 1977, when I returned back to Sacramento, California. And
77 or 87?
87. I keep moving my years up. In 87, I returned back to Sacramento, California, and was unemployed for a period of about 6 months. I had a heck of a time trying to find a job because I had the label of being what was called a brownie, in other words, somebody that had worked for Jerry Brown. I ended up at the California Board of Equalization as a field auditor. I ended up at an entry-level position. And just to make a comparison, when I had left the Youthful Offender Parole Board, I was making about $5,000 a month. When I entered civil service at the Board of Equalization, my salary was $1,700 per month. I stayed there for a period of about 20 years with the board, and I promoted to various positions, associate tax auditor, staff tax auditor, business tax specialist one, business tax specialist two. The business tax specialist two, we were more of a managerial type of a position in terms of classification and pay. However, we were not management because we were still line staff, and I belonged to the California State Employees Association at that point. Later, the SEIU Local 1000 Service Employees International Union. And it was also a steward and a Unit 1 bargaining unit representative. And that position, as the final position as a business tax specialist, too, part of my responsibilities were working in the legal division as what was called an appeals conference auditor. What an appeals conference auditor does is they hold appeals conferences of petitioners, taxpayers who have petitioned their liability. And they want a hearing because they don't feel they should be assessed a certain amount. And we used to hear those hearings, those cases, and write what was called a decision and recommendation. And in most cases, that was the end of it, with a decision and recommendation. And if the taxpayer didn't approve or agree with that decision, then they would appeal directly to the board. I did that for about 2 years. My last year and a half, they made cuts in that section of auditors because they wanted mostly legal attorneys. So I returned back to what is called the Sales and Use Tax Department, where I had come from, as a lead person because I was at that level now. And I oversaw a unit of about 14 people, again as a lead person but not a supervisor. I retired from state service in December of 2005. However, during the last part of 2005, I had accumulated a lot of vacation, so I took about the last 4 months off on vacation. And during that time, I served as a consultant with Sacramento Loaves and Fishes. And came on first full-time February 1st of 2006, at which point I was appointed as the chief financial officer. And that's where I'm at now.
Well, that is a long, long way from the farm worker movement, I must say. retired from the state of California and now chief financial officer for Sacramento charity Loaves and Fishes. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start back in Corcoran, California, where you grew up as a child. Can you begin this conversation by telling us about a little bit about your parents and what they did and your siblings and about you, and what ages are we talking about?
Okay. I was born in Delano, California, April 5th, 1944. I was the smallest of five. I have two brothers and two sisters. My older sister is a half-sister from another father. She's approximately 85, 86 years old. My older sister is around 82 years old. And I'm not quite sure on the dates because it's something that we never really, we never nailed down. And my brothers, my older brother is, again, he's in a half-brother from a different parent. He's 70 years old. My brother, older than me, is 69.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm the smallest. My parents migrated from Mexico during the Revolution in 1910, and they settled in Arizona. The whole family did. I think it was about on Phoenix or someplace around there. It's a fairly large family. There's a lot of Amadas in that area. And at some point, my parents decided to migrate into California, and they came into Delano and settled in Delano. And they were farm workers. They were farm workers until they passed away in the middle 70s. We lived in Delano. Obviously, that's where I was born, and my brothers were born there. My sister was born in Brawley. My other sister, my older sister, was born in Arizona. And where I was born in Delano, was the place no longer exists because they built a freeway over it. And I was...
Were you born at home?
Yeah, we were all home delivered.
All home
delivered. As a matter of fact, the doctor that delivered us, or delivered me, in the when I was going to high school, my wife Chili went to see him because she got some hairspray in her eyes, and I took her in. He was still alive at that time. That was in the 60s already. But Dr. Smith was his name. I don't remember his first name. But he was around for many, many years, and he delivered a lot of babies in Delano.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, we moved to various places in the valley. We were in Dinuba. We went to Hanford, California. And we ended up in Corcoran, California, around 1949. I think I was about 5 or 6 years old. We moved into this labor camp west of Delano. There's a little small airport right outside.
West of Delano?
West of Corcoran.
West of Corcoran.
Yes, west of Corcoran. There's a little airport there, and based on the time from my recollection that it would take us to drive from there to the camp, I would say it might have been about 5, 6, 7 miles at the most. The camp had about 5 or 6 rows of cabins. I don't remember the name of the camp. It had a strange, it belonged to some farmer out there, a grower. They had about that many cabins, or they were basically just cabins. The cabins in those days was just a small room. The frame consisted of whatever goes on the outside, the wood panels. From the inside, you can see the 2x4s that form the frame, form the house. There was nothing on the inside. They had a wire that went up to the middle of the room, and it hung down, and that's where you hooked up whatever you had in the house, whatever electricity you had, but you didn't have any electricity. All you did was just put a light bulb in there, and that's what, that was our light. We didn't have any gas in the units. We had a small stove. In that particular camp, my brothers slept with me in a big bed, and my parents slept in another bed. I believe we had one cabin at that time.
This was all in one room.
Mm-hmm. I remember staying at home during that time, and it used to be cold. It used to be hot in the summertime, and we weren't at that camp very long. One thing that strikes me of that camp, well, several things. One, it was muddy because of the rain outside, and you really couldn't walk outside if you drove. It was just mud all over the place because it rained. What struck me about that camp, that we lived right next to a road that headed further west into what was called a reservoir. In that reservoir, it was miles and miles and miles wide, and it had levees all around it. When it would rain, and there were several levees, several of those reservoirs in Corcoran, and when it would rain, all the water would go into those areas. And during the cotton season, Corcoran was famous for cotton because there was nothing there but cotton. You could go up the levee right before you crossed into that area, and all you would see would be cotton. When the rain would come, you would drive up the road there and go over that, go like if you're going to go under that, into that area, you couldn't get in because all you saw was water. I mean, just miles and miles of water. And then you would see the telephone post, maybe about a couple of feet up, right before it hits the wires, and that's about as high as you could see. And I always used to be afraid as a little boy that somehow that the car was going to go under the water. So I developed a fear for water for many years. The other thing, too, that I remember was that things were rough in those days, and people were very, very different. They would kill dogs because they'd either bit them, they would hit them in the head with a baseball bat. Across the street in that road, I saw several accidents. And there's another thing that always stayed with me. I remember going over there several times, and people used to be curious what happened and who was there and how badly people were hurt. And I remember on several occasions I'd walk over there and I see what I know now as body bags. People that had been put in body bags and were just lying around there. You'd see the black plastic. And on many of these occasions there were front-end collisions during the rain. The streets were one-way streets, real bad. A lot of holes and bumps in them and everything else. Anyway, the nights were cold. Summers, like I said, summers were hot.
So in the cabin there was no insulation of any kind.
No, no insulation at all. No insulation.
Okay.
Yeah, that the other thing we feared, or that I always fear, was that I was always afraid that black widows are going to come up through the wall there or something and under the bed.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
5-6 years.
Well, what about bathroom facilities?
The bathroom facilities, they were outhouses. We'd have to walk in that particular camp, maybe about 30 yards to the back. Water, we had water, and you'd have to go outside and get it out of the water faucets that were scattered throughout the camp. The showers were community showers for the older folks. I don't recall that one, how big that one was, but because I never used it. We took our bath. My mother bathed us in tin tubs inside the cabin. I remember taking a bath about maybe a couple of times a week, and I was usually sick because I used to have asthma when I was a little boy. We left there, and we moved to Herndon, California. It's a real small town just north of Fresno, California. We went there because we went there to pick figs, dried figs, after they fall down to the ground. And I remember as a little boy that I had a small pail, and that was what I was going to use to pick my portion and put it into the boxes. It was hot. It was sandy there, a lot of sand because it was close to a river. We lived at that particular place. We lived in a camp. The camp was made up of tents, army tents, that have a wooden floor. And they've got flaps on the outside that you could lift up to get air in, or if it rains, you put them down. The bathroom facilities were outside, you know, they were outhouses. That particular ranch, that camp, ranch, whatever it was, I don't recall seeing showers at all. Everything was cooked outside. We had, there was a stove outside that several people used. And that's the first place, that's where we lived when I started school. It's a school by the name of Herndon Elementary School. I've tried to find a place in years, but I've never been able to find it. And I can't find it. And I keep going by there, and my brother says that it's been changed to some kind of a truck place, but I don't recall seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
and the whole family worked together picking figs, huh?
The whole family worked together picking figs. It was that's the way we were brought up. Everything we did was as a family unit, and all the money came.
And tell us about picking figs. How do you pick figs?
The figs are, we would pick them off the ground. They fall down to the ground, and they're already almost dried by then. They're dark, and we pick them and put them into pails. And then from the pails, we'd put them into boxes and then stack them like grapes. But the boxes were different kind of boxes. Like grape boxes, but these were bigger and deeper. And then a truck or a trailer would come by and pick them up and take them wherever they were going to take them to.
And the more you picked, the more money you made.
The more you picked, the more money you made. Everything that we did in the fields, the more you picked, the more money you made. That particular place, how it was paid, I don't recall how they paid the fig, but I would assume it was paid by the box. Because at that point, when you pick that kind of fruit in the boxes, then you're going to get paid by the box.
How many hours a day did you work?
Those were that particular place. It was early morning, as soon as you could see, until late in the afternoon, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. I remember it was cold in the morning, but real hot in the afternoon. And then we'd get back to the house, and the sun was beginning to go down. And the next thing we did was my mother was beginning to prepare something to eat.
Well, what were the work conditions like? I mean, were there bathroom facilities available?
No, there were never bathroom facilities. All you would see were trees. You could walk around for distances, and there was nothing but trees. And there were the figs were, and the portion that was picked, the ground was clean. The portion that was not picked, the ground was full of dry figs. I mean, there was literally nothing. Whatever water we had, we brought ourselves. And my dad used to have, they used to buy gallons made of glass, and they'd wrap them with burlap and keep them wet all day long, and hopefully keep them, stop them from getting hot. So you drink.
Yeah, otherwise you'd be drinking hot water. Huh? Yeah,
that's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Except when it really got hot, then that burlap and the cold water you washed it with didn't work. You'd be literally drinking warm water.
Right.
So anyway, we were there a couple of months because we moved back to Corcoran, California. And we moved into a small shack in the south part of town. It was from what I recall, it was a small shack behind somebody else's house, and it was probably about the size of a room and a half. It had a big room, and part of it was a kitchen. And I remember we moved there. It was late fall because I remember kids coming to the door for Halloween, and it was close to a school. A elementary school. The school was by the name of Mark Twain Elementary School. And I mention that because that comes into the picture later on. We were there probably a few months. I don't recall. My dad wasn't, I don't think he was working. He was trying to find work. We were just there. And we didn't even go to school at that time because we didn't know whether we were going to stay there or move out. We ended up shortly thereafter in a camp about 5 miles out of town south. It was J.G. Boswell Camp Number 1. J.G. Boswell owned a lot of property, well, still does, in Corcoran. It's a large, large owner of property, has thousands and thousands and thousands of acres in Corcoran and in the valley. But it had also had a lot of cotton in Arizona. In Corcoran, Boswell had maybe 6-7 camps, labor camps. This particular camp, it was called Camp Number 1 because it was the largest one, and it was the closest one to town. The cabins were better on the outside because they kept them painted, and they had somebody making sure that they were repaired in case something went wrong. But the makeup of the cabin was the same. One cabin, you have a light in the middle, and in that particular camp,
well, concrete camp, floor.
No, those camps had. I think they had wooden floors. They didn't have dirt. It was not dirt. But that particular camp was divided in between your regular cabins, and it had about four rows of tents, those army tents, like the one we lived in Herndon. Those had a wooden floor. And they had the made a military canvas with the, you know, you could lift the sides up. Mm-hmm. We had two cabins, two of those tents. Me and my brother lived in one, and my dad and my mother lived in the other one.
So you lived in the tent cabins then?
There were tent cabins, yeah. For the,
and you?
And we lived there. Later on, we moved into one of the other cabins, but to give you a little bit of the history there, we stayed in that particular tent for several years. The facilities were the same as the most camps, but that one was a little bit more strategically planned. in a way that they had about 40 to 50 cabins per row, and it had about anywhere from 7 to 8 rows. So there were about 400 or 500 cabins in that particular camp.
How many? How many cabins?
About 400 or 500.
Uh-huh.
And that that particular camp was full during the cotton season. I mean, both the cabins and the tents, they were completely full. And between each row, every other row, they built water lines. And so between the rows, that's where they put the rows would be facing each other. That's where they put the water lines and the faucets. So every so often, maybe about every 2 or 3 cabins, there was a faucet. So that's where we got the water. In the cabin section, there was a huge, huge community shower. And I remember it was divided way up to the ceiling, except it was open a little bit up there, and some guys would go up there sometimes and look over the side, see what was on the other side, which was obviously the women. One was for the women, one was for the men. And you walk into the shower, one side had stalls where you took a shower, and the other side had a bench, a long bench, where you sat and you got dressed, and it had nails on top where you could hang your clothes or your towel. You took your own soap, but it had a concrete floor, had drains and everything else. They weren't new. I mean, the inside of those showers were not anything fancy. It was the same makeup as the cabins. There's no insulation, nothing. Just the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The tents. Going back to the tents, I remember many times that we would be sitting down for dinner and we have the light on. Yeah. Here comes a little black widow coming down from the ceiling, trying to get down to the table. And I remember my mother or my dad getting up and getting a paper and just swatting it away or squeezing it and getting rid of it. But our meals at every camp or wherever during that time consisted of your regular staples, beans, potatoes, tortillas, eggs. So we buy a lot of flour, and close to the winter time, if we had money, we'd stock up on beans and on potatoes as much as we could, but we could only, potatoes become rotten after a while. And we always bought cans of lard. Everybody had lard. We'd buy 50-gallon cans or 25-gallon cans, whatever measure they came in. And we made sure we had some of that. We didn't have a refrigerator. At the beginning, we had tubs, and we'd drive into town and go to the ice company and take out a block of ice, take it back and break it up and put it into our tubs where we kept water. And some of the, our meats consisted of bologna, and I don't think they made hot dogs in those days, some hamburger meat. If we had hamburger meat, that was a feast. My mother made tortillas. They were homemade tortillas. She made the beans, and she made the potatoes and everything else.
Did you have rice?
No rice. We didn't have any rice. Mm-hmm. Rice didn't come into the picture years after that.
Mm-hmm.
That was your
diet 3 times a day?
Basically, yeah, and except when I went to school, then I ate whatever we had in school. And then I didn't always have money for school, so I would take a sack lunch, and sack lunch consisted of, it could be a bologna sandwich, or sometimes my mother would change it and give me an egg sandwich. She would fry an egg and put it between 2 slices of bread or in a tortilla. Mostly, usually a tortilla, because it was easier to, it was less expensive to make tortillas than it was to buy bread. But I always liked going to the school, because, there was a warm meal there, and it was good. It was what's now called SOS, over mashed potatoes, and I loved that because that was warm and tasted good, and they served it with a couple of slices of bread and butter. But that was later on. While I was at that particular camp at the very beginning, there's a district, a school district, just further south of there, and probably anywhere from 5 to 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I continued school. And we'd have to walk out to the bus stop, which was about a mile away, and there were buses going in both directions, school buses. Some were going into town and some were going the opposite direction. Well, for some reason, I ended up going into that school. It was Tensmere Elementary School. And it was out in the fields. You could see it on the bare land out there. You drive and you would see it from a distance. It was nothing out there but the school. And the school consisted maybe about... It was like in a square area, and there were buildings around, long buildings, and the classes were in there. In the center, you had a bigger building, which was, I assume, it was the administration building, because that's where the principal was. And then they had swings there in the playground. I continued school in there, and during the time I was there, I was placed in three different rooms. I don't recall why I was moved from the first into the second, but I could have gone from either the first grade to the kindergarten or the kindergarten to the first grade, I don't recall. But one thing that I recall, and it's always stayed in my mind, and when I talk to people about it, it's amazing, because I remember coming back from Christmas, and you know, when you come back from Christmas, the teacher says, "What did Santa Claus bring you for Christmas?" And they go around the room and ask everybody, and people would say, "Well, Santa Claus brought me this and this and this," and they started doing that, and you know, it was like I was totally uncivilized. I didn't know what was going on. I was in a isolated, and all this was new to me. Here I was 5 or 6 years old, and I didn't know what was going on. People were doing these things and talking about these things, and they would say, "Well, Santa Claus brought me this, and Santa Claus brought me this and that," and the first thought that crossed my mind was, "Gee, I didn't see Santa Claus. How did so many people get to see Santa Claus? I never saw Santa Claus." Well, when they got to me, I just said, "Nothing." It was just, it was real strange. And perhaps other kids there belonged to other farm workers' families, but I don't recall that. I remember seeing a lot of the kids that were there were Anglos, and mostly the Anglos were from families that had were either foremen or owners around that area, but there were not very many Hispanics that came from that camp. Anyway, I was then in that room, and right around January, right after Christmas, right after that meeting or that session, they moved me up to the second grade. And so it was in the second grade that I started to do some more meaningful things in school, like writing and spelling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons I think that they put me up so fast, because I was pretty smart to begin with, and my brothers had spent a lot of time with me teaching me how to write and how to spell. I remember in that first camp that we were in, they would sit down and say, "Okay, how do you spell the word orange?" And by that time, I knew how to spell the word orange. I remember orange because it was long. So when I got to Tensmere, they put me up in the second grade. And I was there till the end of the year, or maybe not, because I was there till the end of the year. I guess they closed the school down because the next year, I went to one of the schools in town. It's the same distance to the bus stop, except we were going in the opposite direction. Now we're going towards town. And the school I went to from the third to the sixth grade was Mark Twain Elementary School, which is the one that moved into when we first came back again. And I mentioned that earlier. Anyway, I was there from the third to the sixth grade. There was out of that camp maybe anywhere from 5 to 10 kids that went to school there, and by this time they were beginning to close the camp. I think it was probably the early 50s. We had been working the fields, cotton, mostly cotton, picking cotton in the cotton season, shopping cotton in the daytime. My parents, we used to shop cotton. I used to go out to the field with them. I'd have to sit out there because I couldn't stay home by myself.
Well, let's talk about the cotton for a minute. When you say chopping cotton, what does that mean? Describe that.
In Corcoran, the cotton was planted maybe early spring around there sometime, springtime. And they used to plant the rows, and they were usually a mile long. And when you shove cotton, you're basically just thinning it out because it's pretty thick. And you chop the cotton. The way you do it is you use a long-handled hose, and you go down the row chopping the cotton. And you're spacing it maybe a couple of inches of plants left between each time you hit the hoe. So the more accurate you are and the faster you are, the more rows you're going to make. You're going to complete in chopping cotton.
And
I remember
rows
in those days, the mile rows, they used to pay, I don't know, 50 to 75 cents a row maybe. And it was younger people, that were well, you know, pretty well fit and thin, and if they were pretty accurate, they could maybe do four rows a day, five maybe.
These are mile long rows.
Mile long rows, rows that were a mile long, and that went on through June. I remember because it used to be real hot out there, and there was no bathroom facilities. I used to sit in the car sometimes because I was too young for that particular portion of it. And no bathroom facilities. Water was hot in those days. You had to take your own water. The growers didn't provide anything. The farmers didn't provide anything. So you just went out there and did your rows, and somebody marked them and kept a record, and that's what you got paid for.
And talk about the picking then.
Yeah, and the picking portion, when you go out to the fields, I mean, all you see in Corcoran in those years were white, just completely. It was like it's blanketed in white, and all the fields, as far as you could see, was all white because the cotton was beginning to open. And the typical day was that we get there early in the morning, maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. I hated it because you get there and you walk through the cotton and you get all wet before you get out there because of the dew on the plants. And by that time, the fields are divided and made so the rows are a lot shorter, maybe a mile row. They cut it in half or quarters. And you get there and you go in the car and you have to back up into some of the portions that were already picked because you couldn't, the driving areas were too narrow. And the only ones that were the only things on those rows, on the driving rows, were the trailers, and they were spaced every so many yards across the field.
Mm-hmm.
And they had ladders that went up, so and they could be picking both sides of the field, and then the rows would come into that particular row that ran perpendicular to the rows of cotton. So if you were out in the field picking, you could see the trailer lengthwise from left to right, and you could see the ladder going up, and they were real, some of them were real big, so they had two ladders going up. And you could always see people up there with their sacks and dumping the cotton.
Well, how do you pick cotton?
And then what we used to do is you get, depending how whether you're fast or you're not fast, my parents usually were pretty fast, so they got two rows apiece. And they had a long sack. It's a long sack made out of canvas, a real light canvas, and you strap it around your neck with a pocket on the side. And it could be 6 feet long. The younger you were, you use a 6-footer or a 10-footer or a 12-footer. some of the younger folks, maybe early 20s, they would get a 12-footer. And it's about the, I don't know, maybe the size of a big concrete pipe, size of a potato sack, maybe, about that wide and that long, and it goes along whatever size length you got it. And you pick it, and you pick it off the bowls. The bowls have already opened, the cotton bowl, and you pick the cotton out of there, and the more you could get into your hands before you put it in the sack, the faster you went, and the sooner you were able to fill up your sack. If you put, there's always a method of picking this stuff, and it goes the same for anything you do. And you did out in the field, you learn, you develop a system that you could do it faster. And what you do is you pick the cotton with either hand, and so if you're good at it, you're going to accumulate quite a bit in your hands, and then dump it into the sack. After a while, the sack begins to get full. And you got to start shaking the sack to get it way up to the end. Now, the end is open, except it's tied. You have it tied with a rope. And the reason you tie it is because when you get the sack full and you get on top of the trailer, you couldn't put it in the way that one of those ends is going to be in front of you, if you can do it. Otherwise, you're going to have to reach back and untie it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to put the center of the sack right on your shoulder. So half of us to the front, half of us to the back. And then you stand on there's got a plank. The trailer has a plank from one side to the other. So when you go up the ladder, you get on the plank. And you get in the middle of the trailer, and you start shaking the sack. So part of it's coming out from the front, and part of it is coming out through the back, which you've opened. And then you empty the sack out. Now, before you do that, you've got to get it full out in the field. And if you get it full right away, then you got to carry that thing maybe 150 yards to the trailer.
Well, how much does it weigh?
The weight, it could go, if you were good at it, and if it was a big sack, and if you really packed it in there, and sometimes we liked it if it was wet because it was heavier, because it had moisture in it, but then sometimes it would take off a pound or two. But if you were good at it, and the sack was long enough, you could get 100 pounds of sack.
But 100 pounds,
and they pay 3 cents a pound. So every time you get a full sack, it's about $3. So you get about four or five of those. You get anywhere from $9 to $12 a day. So that was good money in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you use gloves?
We worked as a family. I mean, it all. They gave us the issue. They didn't give us cash then. The way it worked is you get the sack full, and you go out to the front where the trailer is. Usually in front of the trailer, there was a scale, on a tripod, and the scale was coming down the middle, and they hook up the one end of it's got a hook there, to the rope, I think that's what they hooked it up to, and the other end, the strap, they hooked it, they took it up and they wrapped it around the hook, so it was like a bent hot dog there. And it weighed you, and they would tell you how many pounds. And then they had a little machine there. Somebody was always at the machine, and they had small tickets, and they were all rolled. And the tickets were maybe 2x3 or 3x4 or something like that. And they were timber rolls, and they perforated. And they would the machine would, it was like, a, I think it was an adding machine. And they would punch in the pounds that you had. And you keep that ticket because that's money.
Mm-hmm.
When you were done, you shave the ticket, then you go upstairs, and you go up to the top of the trailer, and you dump the sack, and you empty the sack, and you dump the cotton in. And then you go back and continue. That goes on day after, during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the fields, they had sprayed so much chemicals in them that every time I went out there, whatever pesticide they used to affect me a lot, and because of the asthma that I had, and so I'd get sick. So I was sick,
mm-hmm.
and I hated it. I hated working in the fields. And so this would go on, and I remember a lot of the times when you were leaving the field, the sun was going down. I mean, there's late. It was late in the day. He said, get home, it was already dark.